Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Recently on Preaching and Preachers, we've introduced a new type of episode called The Mailbag. And for me, this began, frankly, out of an appreciation for the Kansas City Star here in Kansas City. And not just the print edition, but the online edition, where they have a mailbag, where different sports writers for, let's say, the Royals or the Chiefs will actually take incoming messages from social media and kind of tick through those. And I always, as a reader, enjoy reading through those as much as I have time to keep up with the Chiefs and the Royals. That idea, coupled with the fact that I get asked on a near daily basis through social media or bumping into students on campus or ministers in conferences and other places, hey, what about this? What about this question about preaching or about pastoring or about leadership? And so we decided to start this new type of episode called The Mailbag, where we receive just different questions, and I try to batch those thematically so that they're not all over the map and in a total potpourri, but if we can kind of batch three or four or five or six questions thematically, that way we're driving home a particular series of questions under one theme. So today we're in the mailbag together. Thank you for sending in your questions, and I want to invite you to send those to us, especially through Twitter. You can send those to the Twitter handle, PreachingJKA. That's at PreachingJKA, and that's the Preaching and Preachers Twitter handle. Follow us on Twitter and shoot questions at us through that, and we can receive those and engage these periodically. So today's theme is the preacher and his personal life. And again, we just pulled some of the different questions that really fall into this category. I'm pleased to tackle these. Number one, we have a question here from Nelson Nisley. Nelson Nisley asks, how do people who are not naturally outgoing, who do not easily remember names, and who like alone time succeed in church ministry when the expectations are that you will be everywhere, every time, remember everybody's name, and never be tired of it all? So I guess if I were to encapsulate that question, it would be, you know, how does an introvert survive? But I'm going to try to unpack this question in a more thorough way and just recognize a few obvious facts, and then hopefully give a few words of helpful encouragement as well. First of all, it doesn't matter how small the church is, how extroverted you are, how good of a recall you have with names. It really isn't possible for a pastor to know everybody and to be everywhere all the time. Churches develop cultures. Churches develop expectations, no doubt. And if you're going to a church to pastor and the previous pastor was omnipresent, who was always in the hospitals, always in the homes, and was Mr. Gregarious, Mr. Affable, always with people, Mr. Extrovert, always engaging people and always remember names, then yeah, look, pastorally, you're at a disadvantage. And so I want to acknowledge on the front end, you do have to be mindful of your predecessors and the basic levels of a church's expectations. Some of that can be flushed out in the interview process where you talk not only about the church, its needs, yourself, your gifting, but also past pastors. And what was their currency? How did they make their way in the congregation? And the fact of the matter is, if you are following a pastor that was so inclined, you're working uphill a bit, pastorally speaking. At the same time, I want to be careful that we don't simplify life and fall into two different categories. I'm an extrovert. I'm an introvert. And I understand those are real categories. I'm not denying those altogether, but I do think we oversimplify things, and we at times use those categories as a cop-out. I will at times hear people say something like, you know, I'm an introvert, so I don't like being around people, or I'm an introvert, I'm going to take a pass on church fellowships. I'm an introvert, so I'm going to hire an associate minister to do more of the people touching, so to speak. And look, I want to be sympathetic to pastors. If you are more introverted, I mean, I get that, and that means you're going to have to be intentional to schedule more time in for you to recoup from the social engagement and from those pastoral touch situations. But at the same time, even if you are a capital I introvert, and even if your church is incredible in their understanding and their sympathy, you're still going to have to bust out of the bubble at times. You're still going to have to be with the people of God. You still need to do your best to remember names. You still need to do your best to engage people. Let me give you one particular tip here that I have found to be incredibly helpful in this regard, and then I'll unpack a couple others afterwards. The first tip is never underestimate the value of 10 minutes before and after each service. And so to be there, to be visual, to be present 10, 15 minutes before the service starts, 10, 15 minutes afterwards on Sunday morning, and if you have a Sunday night service, if you have a Wednesday night service, or other congregational touch points, that presence means a great deal to people. And you can have high-touch opportunities by just walking slowly amongst the people of God, shaking hands, perhaps giving a side hug, and pausing to pray with people as needed. And so I'll do this all the time. I prioritize this. So a person comes up to me 5 minutes before the service starts, and they say, "Pastor, I really have a prayer request. Can I visit with you this week about it?" Well, potentially, but what I will usually do, say something like this, well, we have a few minutes now. Can you share it with me now? And in fact, I'll pray with you now. That is a number of things. First of all, that 5 minutes just saved you probably an hour during the week. Secondly, it prevents you from forgetting about it during the week. Or heaven knows, if you say, "I'll get back with you," and you forget, then they're upset. You feel terrible. Thirdly, it enables you to actually minister to that person then. Look, the power of prayer is not in the optics, right? But that person knowing not only that you might pray for them, or even receiving the assurance that you will pray for them, but actually praying for them in that setting, in that moment, means a great deal to them. So I found over the years, kind of 1 hour, 10 minutes before and after this service, 10 minutes before and after that service, 10 minutes before and after Wednesday night, 1 hour of intentionality literally can save 10 hours during the week. What is more, it can make up for your absence in other settings. Secondly, I also want to say along those lines is prioritize the handwritten note. We tend to send text messages of thank you or emails of thank you. Why? Because they're easier. We can send those more quickly. It does take a little bit longer to send a handwritten note, but it means so much more because people discern that you've taken the time to write it, to mail it. There's a joy in the surprise of there being a handwritten note in the mailbox, and the people have that note as an artifact, as a reminder that you care for them, that you did indeed pray for them, that you do indeed love their family. Many church members will keep those handwritten notes in their pastor and save them forever, stick them in their Bible, put them in their prayer journal as an artifact that the church cares for them, that the pastor cares for them. There's so much more I could say to this point. Perhaps just another word or two here as it relates to names. I certainly don't bat 1,000 here. I lead an institution that has thousands of students and literally hundreds of faculty and staff and part-time staff. Then I, in my social circles with my local church and my wife and our kids and those families, and then I'm currently preaching pastor on an interim basis in Jackson, Mississippi at First Baptist Jackson, which is a major church, and there are north of 1,000 people every Sunday there. And so, man, I live with a tinge of guilt in my life about not quite remembering that person's name. And I want to say, just try to right-size that expectation. Don't beat yourself up if you can't remember names. I think intuitively you'll be able to prioritize the names you need to be most intentional to remember, frankly, those people you want to, in particular, to touch, to minister to, the people that are in leadership positions in the church and you need to engage them during the week. So don't beat yourself up, but do try to prioritize learning the key names. For me, a handshake, a repeating their name back to them when they say it to me, that generally helps. But I'll confess, my life would be a lot easier on Sundays if everybody sat in the same place every week, wore the exact same clothes every week, and wore a name tag every week. Then I could remember those names pretty easily. But the fact is, with people coming and going and out of church so often and then sitting different places, obviously dressing differently week to week, and virtually no one wearing a name tag, you're at a strategic disadvantage in a large church. But don't give up the effort. Keep trying to learn those names. All right, question number two comes at me from Jacob Helsley. Jacob Helsley. Jacob asks, "How do you establish and maintain healthy balances as a husband, father, pastor, with hobby, recreation, fitness thrown in?" Man, that's a great question. And how do I maintain that healthy balance? Well, I suppose I maintain it imperfectly. Healthy balance is the aspiration, and that ebbs and flows as to the relative health in my life. I will put out a few markers for you here. First of all, I'll say to you, I'm 41 years old. I have 5 children now. My oldest just turned 16 about a week or two ago, so I'm coping emotionally with a 16-year-old. I say that with a smile on my face. And then my children are 16, 14, 13, 11, 10. So they're at an age where a lot of time is needed from them and by them, and a lot of time is eager to be given by me. What does that time look like? It looks like spiritual formation in their life. it looks like just having good conversations. And by that, I don't mean grunts at the dinner table. I mean eye to eye, face to face, one on one. How was your life? How are your studies? How are your goals? How are your athletic goals? How are your spiritual goals? How are your academic goals? How are things at school? How are your friends? What do you hope to accomplish this summer? You know, those sorts of questions, not questions that are yes or no questions, but questions that prompt them to talk back. I have learned in life, whether it's with my wife or my children or any other meaningful relationship, there is no substitute for that one-on-one, eye-on-eye, face-to-face conversation, personal engagement. Here's the reality. That takes time. But the truth of the matter is love is spelled T-I-M-E. So the ages of my kids, not just for the conversations, but right now in my life, we have ballet rehearsals going on. We have varsity girls basketball practice going on. We have a junior high boys basketball practice going on, and then even a sub-junior high boys basketball practice about to start. A general principle we have for us is kind of one activity at a time for our kids. So we're one kid isn't going from ballet practice to basketball practice to chess club practice to clarinet practice. No, it's kind of one recreational activity at a time, one extracurricular activity at a time, unless there's a really compelling reason why there should be something else in addition. So an awareness of one's life stage is what I'm getting at. My wife and I have been married 20 years next year. She still is my favorite person to be with, my favorite person to be around, my favorite person to spend time with. So I don't have to prioritize time for her in some sense that I'd rather not be doing it. No, it's the natural response. The intuitive response for me is to want to be with her. So my life stage is family time is pretty high, more so than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And it will probably intensify over the course of the next 5 or 6 years. So that's family. For me, my primary vocational responsibility obviously is leading Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Spurgeon College. The reality is that is a commitment that I could give all the hours I have in the week, none to my family, none to my personal spiritual life, none anything else, and I could still give more. It's kind of like pastoring a church. You can always make another pastoral visit. You can always spend more time on a sermon. You can always do things. So for me, I try to think in basic brackets of time. This many hours this day, this many hours this week. And I think about that as it relates to administrative responsibilities, as it relates to speaking responsibilities and writing responsibilities, things that do indeed further the work of the seminary. So I look at it, and frankly, this is a simplistic analogy, I know, but think of it as a pie and how I'm going to slice up that pie and allocate time. So my challenge is no 2 weeks are ever identical. But if I am in town with not it being a high point week like trustee meeting or something where there's heavy entertainment, but a typical week of when I'm in town, and yes, there no doubt will be a campus guest or two to take to lunch or to dinner, but a predictable, manageable amount of entertainment, then my early mornings are for devotion, for exercise, for study, for reading, for writing, kind of into late mornings on chapel days or chapel, and then usually a lunch appointment after chapel, then an afternoon of correspondence, of office appointments, of the basic mechanics of the seminary. Evenings, I live on campus. I don't have a commute, which is nice, so I'm home in 30 seconds for dinner. We prioritize those as a family. And then the evenings, best I can be, are with the family, and then as I'm getting later into the evening is kind of reading until I go to sleep. So the reality is you can't do everything. I think the key is to assess your season of life and on the front end to allocate time in accordance with God's ordained responsibilities in your life, God's ordained roles and goals for your life. And then on the front end and the back end, acknowledge this will be imperfect. Things will happen. Things will get out of my control. But in as much as I can drive those decisions on the front end, just like I budget my money, as much as I can budget my time on the front end, that tends to help me prevent catastrophe from happening. One other footnote here. As it relates to time and preachers, look, sermon prep is obviously key here. And one of the things that you'll have to come to grips with is the fact that you do not have an infinite amount of time to spend on every sermon. And look, there are certain texts that are knottier than others. There are certain weeks that are more challenging than others. And so you can't just say, I'm going to give, 7.5 hours to Sunday morning sermon, period. I get that. But you do need to, on the front end, have a basic sense of, okay, Sunday's 5 days out. This text is going to be challenging for me. And so I need to really plan on 10 to 12 hours for this sermon and understand that could creep upwards to 14 or 15. But don't just kid yourself and say, I'm going to plan for 5 hours knowing it could be 10 or 15. And so taking that pie, slicing it, understanding that that could creep, but you've made some basic allocations on the front end. My fitness is very erratic. I mean, I try to maintain some daily exercise, but traveling compromises that and other responsibilities. My recreation, as it relates to me, tends to be my family. I mean, I rarely play a round of golf. I wish I had more time for that. I enjoy recreational reading with the New Bethina students here on campus, looking to shoot some basketball in there with students and staff here to help with exercise. But recreation tends to be things I enjoy doing with my family. And then hobbies, well, I don't really have much of, many hobbies these days. I'm not out hunting deer weekly or catching fish or the types of things that would usually fall in the hobby category. But I do not want to undersell the importance of fitness and the importance for some healthy recreation. For me, the fitness is not all that should be, and recreation intersects very nicely with family activities. And then occasionally, and hopefully more so in the future now that we have the Student Center, with students and faculty and staff here. So that's how I very imperfectly manage my time. All right, I'm going to interrupt myself here for a moment and pause for a brief word of update from Midwestern Seminary.
Midwestern Seminary's 81-hour Master of Divinity degree prepares you for ministry today and tomorrow. Midwestern Seminary's flagship degree program is our primary track for ministry preparation. Requiring only 81 credit hours, the MDiv program is an efficient option for students, equipping them to serve the church in pastoral ministry. Residential students will be trained in a unique community environment passionately focused on the local church. Online students can earn the full degree without leaving their current ministry context. Come be a part of one of the fastest growing seminaries in North America as we develop a new culture of discipleship devoted to the local church and committed to taking God's unchanging word into a rapidly changing world. Visit mbts.edu/mdiv today.
All right, I'm back on the podcast today, Preaching and Preachers, engaging this mailbag, and I'm talking today about the preacher and his personal life and fielding questions from friends accordingly. Terry Lang asked this question. If you have finished seminary a while ago, in his circumstance, 9 years, how can one find an effectively transition into full-time vocational ministry? Question again by Terry Lang. If you have finished seminary a while ago, in his case, 9 years, how can one find and effectively transition into full-time vocational ministry? Let me give you a couple of keys here. First of all, people who exist on the periphery of a seminary's community or on the periphery of a denomination's community will exist on the periphery of a seminary's community or the periphery of a denomination's community. So occasionally I have the seminary student who kind of hangs out off campus, doesn't come to chapel, shows up, when classes begin, zips out as soon as classes end. They never really engage in the life of the seminary community. Well, guess what? In addition to robbing yourself of discipleship opportunities and 1,000 other benefits of being a residential student, you also go through seminary without professors knowing you, without me knowing you. And so I don't have enough of a face and a name and awareness of that person's gifts to be able to recommend them to full-time ministry. Similarly, if a person just kind of hangs out on the periphery of the denomination, they never really engage churches or other pastors or associational leaders or state convention leaders or denominational leaders, no one knows who they are, and they're not in a position to be able to recommend them. So I want to encourage you, first of all, to take the initiative. You've been out of seminary for 9 years. If you still have relationships with any of those professors, I would write them today. Email them today. Talk about your desire to be a full-time pastor. I would meet with associational directors of mission, or what they now refer to as associational mission strategists. Let them know of your desires. Again, I would shake trees. You can do that in a way that is not self-promoting, but that is letting people know of your desires and your ambitions for ministry. Look, to be a full-time vocational minister is a noble goal. That frees you up to minister more, can relieve burdens on your family and so forth. So I think that's a noble goal to have. My very first pastorate, I'm a first-year MDiv student. I'm looking for that first pastorate. And I mean, I'm in Kentucky. I'm new there. I'm trying to initiate some of these relationships I've just encouraged you to do. And I had a couple of churches come to me and present me with really attractive part-time options, meaning like part-time work, but not full-time pay, but certainly north of a traditional, you know, part-time salary for a minister. But I really had the goal to have a full-time ministry position because my wife was expecting our first child. I wanted my wife to be on the baby. And so to make this work, the salary needed to at least resemble full-time pay and at least resemble full-time benefits. And I kind of held out for a few months until that happened, and I'm really glad I did because God led me to a great church with sweet people who provided for us in a full-time way, and that really springboarded us onto a life now nearly 20 years later of a fruitful ministry. So make those desires known. All right, the preacher in his personal life, the final question here, the fourth question is this, from Tyler Shores. What one preacher of the past would you recommend a pastor to get well acquainted with besides Spurgeon? Okay, I'll put a smiley face there. Tyler puts a smiley face there. So for me, if you know me, if you guys have listened to this podcast much, you probably picked up on this. I love reading biographies all the time of world leaders, of military leaders, of political leaders, and most especially of church and Christian leaders. So, you know, is there one person that I would recommend? Well, I would recommend to you to find that one person for you. You may read broadly and read many biographies, but probably at some point there will be one particular biography or one particular preacher or Christian leader that really, really resonates with you. So I just throw out some names here. Acquaint yourself with Jonathan Edwards. Why? Well, you see his incredible discipline, his incredible self-sacrifice, the fact he was America's leading theologian in the colonial era and perhaps ever. And to see his discipline, his study, the fact he was ejected from his church and he went to be a missionary to Indians, read that story. Acquaint yourself with the great biographies of Edwards, you know, the Marsdens, the Ian Murrays, those great biographies. Acquaint yourself with the Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was such a phenomenal preacher post, during and post-World War II in London of Westminster Chapel. Again, the Ian Murray biography there is incredible. I read that early in ministry. It was so very helpful. And then you could just sprinkle it around the different great preachers, you know, the different great reformers, Martin Luther, John Calvin, John Knox, the great missionaries, William Carey, Adoniram Judson. I mean, the list does go on and on. And every name I mention here, there are at least a few good biographies. I still remember reading Timothy George's biography on William Carey, you know, nearly 20 years ago now, as I was, you know, processing a call to ministry and processing what I would do with my life for Christ. You know, Roland Bainton's biography of Martin Luther, Here I Stand. I mean, again, the list goes on and on. And so I would encourage you to read broadly from biographies and don't begin necessarily with the definitive biography. So Martin Lloyd-Jones's, you know, two-volume biography by Ian Murray is, what, 1,200 pages, give or take. You don't have to begin with that. You know, the little series that Reformation Trust by Ligonier Ministry does on these different preachers, Steve Lawson has written a number of those and others have contributed to that series, but you have little, you know, kind of 120, I guess, maybe 140-page bios of Martin Luther, of John Calvin, of John Knox, of Martin Lloyd-Jones, of Charles Spurgeon. Most recent volume came out in recent days by Mark Dever on Richard Sibbes. Read those. You can read those in an afternoon or an evening, and that might launch you into a deeper investigation with someone that you want to get acquainted with from church history. And they become to you not just a person from the past, but a friend for the present. And to bring this conversation full circle today, here's what's interesting. As you developed relationships with great figures of church history, again, they leap off the page and they're not only heroes from the past, they are friends and counselors for the present. Guess what all those people had in common? Luther, Calvin, Spurgeon, Edwards, Whitfield, William Carey, Adoniram Judson. What do they have in common? They all had not perfect, but what I would say very intentional personal lives. They tended to be disciplined. They tended to be driven. They tended to have a gospel ambition. They tended to live in momentous times when momentous things were happening. So as you read those, you will be instructed not just about the big questions of ministry and preaching. You will be inspired not just to do great things for Christ, but you'll be inspired in how to better order and discipline your personal life. Thank you, friends, for joining me on Preaching and Preachers. Again, I want to encourage you, send questions our way at preachingjka, at preachingjka. We'd love to engage these for you. Thanks for listening to Preaching and Preachers. I'm delighted and honored to host this podcast and delighted and honored to get to encourage friends like you. Thank you for being with us today and for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, go to my website, jasonkallen.com. That's jasonkallen.com.